Our guest today is someone who, quite honestly, I've been wanting to speak to for a long time. What he stands for is everything that this podcast stands for and I stand for, and the reason why I started this podcast. He is the founder of Ulysses Inc., a consulting firm. He's also the author of Scrum a Pocket Guide, which is in its third printing as of January this year, 2021. And he has recently started The Value in the Scrum Values, his workshop. You can catch the next one on the 7th of May and on the 28th of May. They sell out very quickly, so I'd highly recommend you getting your tickets as soon as possible. Wildly popular. Are you ready? Can you handle it? Here we go. The Independent Scrum Caretaker.
Welcome to the podcast that challenges you from the inside. Come be more and discover the agile within. And now here's your host, Greg Miller.
Well, thank you very much, Greg, for having me on the show. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your time. We definitely appreciate it. So let's dive right in. I know you've been focused a lot on humanizing the workplace with Scrum and around the values. And that's really a big topic of mine, something that this show is really centered around. So how can we dive into Scrum and have Scrum help us with the understand the values better?
Yeah, well, it's indeed one of my main focuses on Scrum, let's say, because I feel, Greg, I don't know how you see that, but Scrum has been around for a while, sort of 25 years in the meantime. And I feel in those 20 to 25 years of Scrum so far, we have achieved a lot, real a lot, amazing. But what I still feel needs a lot more attention of us and hopefully of practitioners around the world is the people aspect of Scrum. So from that industrial past, I don't know how you see that we were sort of dragged into the old school thinking, waterfall, linear approach, sequential phases and so on, all very long and I would almost say boring, and certainly not a good fit for the creative process that software development is, which is why we use Scrum. I feel that we've been overly focused on process, which is good. It has helped us a lot. But the people aspect, I still see that a lot of companies struggle with it. And that also expresses it. It is also expressed in the way that companies approach whatever they call their agile transformation. That's why my it's sort of my built-in focus on the people, the human side of Scrum, let's say.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'm right there with you. In my experience has been that pretty much every place I've been, I'm a Scrum Master, and I started off in QA and was a BA on agile teams, Scrum teams. So I've been in it for about 10 years, and most every place I've been is focused on the process, like you said, and very, very, it's like a secondary, if they give it thought at all, is the people, and they kind of realize as they're going through agile transformation. I sometimes say, I don't think they knew what they signed up for when they think it's just a process that's going to make them go faster and maybe be more competitive. and they forget that the, and I think this is the hardest part, and you've probably seen it too, is the change that's needed in the inner, going from waterfall to Scrum. One thing that, as I was researching into preparing for this show is, I saw a little clip you did on the illusion of agility that really, really resonated with me. And I liked what you said about that, is that, kind of what we're saying here is that, they think they're agile, they're doing agile, right? And they don't really realize, what they're in for, all the other values and the principles of the Agile Manifesto and all that, all that like that. So what do you, what are your thoughts around the illusion of agility?
Well, it's sort of in a way connected to what I call humanizing the workplace, or sort of the lack of humanization of the workplace, let's say. So a lot of large organizations, but often, much to my surprise, not just large organizations, but even small and medium organizations, but certainly very clearly large organizations, they want to become more agile, right? So and they often look at Scrum. They're probably not really sure why, but you know what? Everybody else is doing, so they want to do that too. They don't really think about what they're hoping to achieve, what their sort of main urgencies are, and so on. So they just dive into it. And what do they typically do? So they apply ways of working, change processes, and so on, the way they've done it in the past. But the problem is, the problems of the past is what they want to get rid of. So they want to outgrow slow, long phases types of processes. So they want to get away from that. And the problem is, when they apply what they're used to doing, they're applying a sort of industrial approach to become more agile, which one of the things is that it doesn't have enough focus on the people aspect, what we just talked about, but it sort of industrializes their way of working. What I often say is, you can introduce Scrum as a sort of standard way of working in an organization, but what I like to say also, it doesn't mean that you have to industrialize your Scrum to death. Scrum is in that sense a framework. It creates a lot of openness. So why I say on the topic of the people aspect that Scrum is actually more about behavior than it is about process. And why is that? The process just installs a sort of simple, lightweight framework. It gives direction to people. It structures the way of working a little bit. But it surely doesn't give answers to every possible question, and certainly not upfront. It doesn't tell people what sort of meetings to hold or whatever. So in the end, the real benefits you get out of Scrum is from collaborating and interacting within the framework. And when companies introduce an agile way of working in that large scale, what I often call mass production types of ways, that's the old school way of working. It doesn't allow contextual fine-tuning, tweaking, and so on. So to give you an example of that, what I call industrializing your Scrum to death is, in a lot of larger organizations, they introduce Scrum. And I don't know whether you've seen that, they impose a fixed sprint length on every single team in the complete organization. It means everybody has to do Scrum. And nowadays, it seems that everybody thinks they have to do two-week sprints. So a management or leadership or transformation leads, whatever it, or coaches sometimes, they tell all teams throughout an organization to work on the same sprint length, and even worse, to have the same start and end date. And I'm like, mm-hmm. Oh my God, that is taking away the openness that Scrum offers you, because in a way, sprint length, like many practices or many things that you want to organize your Scrum with, should allow you to tune, to tweak your Scrum to your context. In that sense, in the same organization, maybe for product A or for system B or for service C, a different sprint length is the most desirable. Maybe at a product, some product, they want to work in two-week sprints, and another type part of the organization, three-week sprints, would be the best for them. So that sort of, you can standardize on Scrum so that everybody knows what is a sprint, what are the accountabilities of Scrum, how does Scrum actually work. But still, in every specific context, you can have a sort of different implementation of Scrum. And that's what I miss. And that's an effect of that sort of mass production approach to an agile transformation. Everybody following the same rules, the same practices, and so on. And it sort of destroys the openness, which is sad. And that's what I call the illusion of agility.
Uh-huh. Right.
Because organizations introduce it via a supposed cookbook approach, copy-pasting what other companies are doing, implementing some sort of blueprint model without thinking and considering what is needed, what is not needed, how to tune that, industrializing the Scrum to this, mass production, all teams in a complete organization suddenly having to go through the same trainings and almost overnight having to suddenly, you know, be or act agile. And after a while, they find out that what they were hoping to achieve in Scrum, and that's often improving customer satisfaction, decreasing time to market, increasing the quality of their products, reconnecting with their consumer base, re-engaging the workforce, right? Humanizing the workplace, it's not happening. And that's what I call the illusion of agility. They thought they were increasing their agility. They fought for themselves that they were increasing their flexibility, speed, responsiveness, ability to change direction, do something new and so on, even their ability to innovate. And after a while, they find out, so we've now introduced Scrum. Everybody's doing Scrum in that sense. Everybody's following the process. And then they wonder, where's the improvement? And that's when the moment that I call deflation by reality, that follows the illusion of agility. Ah.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I heard you say that. Yes. So how do we, in your experience, how do you introduce, so a team is, or a company is following the process, Scrum, they're not getting what they want. How do we introduce these values into an organization and help them be agile instead of just following the process? Is there any advice you have?
Well, it's certainly not an easy road. I don't know whether you noticed that, because the reason why a lot of those organizations go for the approach that we just talked about is they think it's an easy road. They think they can easily copy paste what other people are doing, that they can easily implement an existing model. I don't know, how have you seen it over time? There was at some point in time at least some sort of Spotify hype. You know?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I have. Yeah, people want to copy that. Yes, yes, that's right.
So when you hear people talking about Squat, you know that it's been at least some influence of the Spotify model, which actually wasn't a model, again. And then people go through all of that, and then you can't avoid the hard work, right? Meaning transforming your organization from an old school, silo-based, very departmental, structured organization towards a flexible organization that is, as an organization, has agility almost in its structures, that is not an easy road. And that requires, and that's the big problem, the big contradiction almost. You have to do that almost in an agile way. But they're not used to think and work in an agile way. Now, one of the aspects indeed is how to help them almost live the values, enact the values. And the problem is, it's not the one or the other. The difficulty is that practices and even applying the Scrum process, so practices and values for me go hand in hand. You can't program people's mindset. You can't plug in a USB cable into somebody's head and just download new values. It doesn't work like that. Luckily, it doesn't work like that.
Right.
So practices and values go hand in hand. So I think it requires courageous people around the world, and not just Scrum Masters, not just management leadership, but also teams themselves to apply the practices. And then regularly think of the values. Is this reinforcing the values, what we're doing? And in what sense is it reinforcing the values? So values and practices, for me, go hand in hand. You can't just do practices without having the values in the back of your head. You can't just first try to get all of the values right in people's head and then start applying new practices. And the idea is it's not industrial. It's falling, getting back up, learning, improving, changing, trying something else, experimenting. And in that sense, it requires the courage for an organization, in my view, to also try to build on the collective intelligence, the creativity of people. So it requires some sense of engagement of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned engagement is key. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. I one thing I try to do is I do try to get the teams engaged that there's a lot of people that, people are different. You have to read the temperature of the team. Some people are quiet, not that they're not engaged. They just don't speak up. I try to encourage them and get them to speak up. But one thing that I try to do as far as the values is I think it's the best way is to just lead by example. Having courage to just, speak up and protect the team and speak up for the team in front of them. I found that that's a good way to build trust and just being open with them, just telling them, not blunt, but trying to soften things, but tell them my open, honest opinion on things.
Yep.
And let them know that it's okay for them it's okay to express your opinion. No one's going to, if you tell me that you don't like Scrum, which is fine, because in the beginning, a lot of teams don't like it. Tell me that you don't like it, but then tell me why. And that's okay. I'm not going to run to your manager and get you in trouble. That's a couple of things that I've tried to do. You have similar experiences?
Yeah, absolutely. I totally recognize that. So some of my most powerful experiences were, just to summarize it a little bit, is in also what we call take it to the team. So I often certainly as a Scrum Master, I often felt a little bit lonely. Because you have this sense of having one foot in the team, but on the other hand, also one foot not, because you also want to address the organization and in a way connect the team to the organization. You want to be able, like you just said, bring in honest, open opinions as sort of, you want to have some sort of neutrality in that. And at points, at times, I felt like really lonely because, at the same point in time, you're part of the team, you're not part of the team, you also have other things to do, and you want to work with the organization. And at some point in time, when I really felt almost emotional over that, right. I had to go to an experience sometimes of just taking it to the team. So at some retrospective, stop trying to be the brave, bold, courageous, whatever guy, and just express my feelings to the team. And I was not that much about giving my opinion about what I saw happening, but sharing my emotions. And because when you say, I recognize leading by example, but also in the sense of, helped me at least a lot, showing vulnerability. So sharing with teams, hey guys, this is how I feel. I feel sort of lonely. You're doing lots of stuff. I love what you're doing. You're having great results, but I feel locked out a little bit. Yeah. And then a couple of times I got the feedback from the team saying, hey, Bekanto, we love you. We love what you do. You create a great environment. It's where we can prosper. We love this. So, we're sorry if you feel locked out. And then I started realizing, it's just part of, in a way, my role as a Scrum Master. It really, really helps them. So, and in that sense, you lead by example also by showing the fact that it's also a humanized work environment in that sense. Mm-hmm. Emotions are important too. We don't have to go to the office and leave emotions, our personal life, our personal concerns, whatever, behind us. That wouldn't be humane, right? So, and then indeed, that's leading by example. Cool.
Yeah, definitely. You said it better than I did. Vulnerability. And I identify with that loneliness, especially in lockdown now, or COVID, even worse. I mean, in my case, it's about a year ago, I got laid off due to COVID from my role. And then I was able to, I got a new role over the summer. And I've never met my team face to face. I've never even seen some of them over Zoom on camera. I've never been to an office, never met my manager. And it's different. And I did, like you mentioned, I did one time, mention to, a couple people on the team. I don't think it was the whole team. I did say that I feel lonely. I feel, like I'm not part of the team, because they had been working together for a while. I mean, years in Waterfall before we came to Scrum. So they knew mm-hmm. each other. They were always on Jabber, and, you know, I'm not on that. And they don't really need me a lot, to be honest. Even they're a new Scrum team. They don't have a lot of impediments for me to remove. And, you know, I set up the events and I show up to the events, right, over Zoom and stuff, and we talk and I help them. But you're right. I actually said, I don't feel like I'm part of the team. And then I noticed, they started, wanting to do one-on-ones with me. And that's where I really started connecting with them. I do one-on-ones periodically, getting to know them as a person, like you said, humanizing it and talking about not just work, but, like there, an example is, I have a team that is working, you know, over 50 hours a week, and I'm trying to cut that down because I don't think seems like a sustainable pace. And they've opened up to me and told me that they don't like working that. So I'm trying to connect with them on that way. So you're exactly right with about humanizing. Yeah, I can relate to a lot of that.
Yeah, and I like the example that you just gave about the overtime, because in a way what you're doing, and I love that, I recognize that, is you're trying to create a sort of safe environment for them. Mm-hmm. But safety is not silently doing what people expect you to do. Safety in an environment of Scrum, and you're creating a safe environment, is an environment where people have the courage and feel the liberty to speak up and to share things that are bothering them, or different opinions, and go into some sense of constructive conflict. And I like, because in the way that you sense that this is not okay, this is not sustainable, that overtime mm-hmm. things and so on. It's probably also not good for quality and so on, because that's what experience shows. It just sends out a signal that we're really busy. And it looks like commitment, and it looks like engagement, like you sense it is not. But I'm fond of the way that you bring that to the team, and mm-hmm. you ask them to think about it. You don't say it's bad. You create an environment where people feel that they can finally speak up on that, and that is actually very unsafe behavior in a traditional environment, because it's generally not what we expected people to do in the past. So I like that a lot. And what it helped me also a lot with that leading by example. So we're just talking about our relationship with the teams, Greg. So that's cool. Mm-hmm. But what helped me a lot, at least. So the last couple of years, I've been working a lot with CXO teams, also management teams of organizations. And in a sense, it may sound strange, but approaching those people as people has helped me a lot.
Right.
Because if you go to them and almost upfront act like a sort of subordinate or a sort of not so great person just because you're addressing management is not helpful. So I've tried to talk to them as let's say fellow human beings. And that has helped me a lot. Because what I noticed with them, like you've now felt some sort of problems with the team and not speaking up. What I noticed with a lot of managers and leadership, and that helped me a lot, is that they truly care for their people. But for some reason, they climbed the ladder, and it looks like a lot of people think that they now have to leave emotions behind, because as they climb the ladder, that they have to be the strong, whatever sort of leading manager and so on. And when I sort of open up to them, they start opening up to me, and great things come out of that. And that is, for me, so important in introducing Scrum. Because it's not just with the teams, also with management. And like you said, what you just said, introducing yourself with the team, getting to know them mm-hmm. is really important. It's a way to introduce that behavior into an organization, or that behavioral change. It's a mm-hmm. slow thing. Another thing I've tried to do that I focused a lot on getting over the illusion of agility or not ending up in illusion of agility is also to make change in a way small again for organizations. because I talk about those mass production, that mass production approach, all teams going to the same training over a limited amount of time, if not overnight, or sort of leaving the office by Friday and expecting everybody to come back in an agile organization on Monday morning. I try to make it small again. And that's I try to get management and CXO to think in following terms. So you've now introduced Scrum massively, large scale. Let's now pick one initiative only, one product, one service, one project, whatever you want to call it, one initiative. And let's have a closer look at how they're doing Scrum. And let's try to improve sort of their Scrum. Let's reimagine their Scrum. So think in terms of end-to-end value delivery, the accountabilities of Scrum, product backlog as the one plan and so on, facilities, infrastructure, support, technology, tools, whatever, to produce as on that one initiative, at least what I call tasty, right? Tasteful, tasty sashimi releases of product.
Yeah.
And then, but just for that one initiative, and then make it small again. And it feels like, yeah, this is going to go too small. But imagine 2, 3, 4 years sometimes before they wake up, hard wake up call, deflation by reality, wake up call from oh my God, this is only an illusion of agility. Now let's make it small. And then again, our approach comes into play as a Scrum Master trying to create a safe environment for the team, but also as a Scrum Master try to help stakeholders, management, people outside of the Scrum team, external to the Scrum team, and the Scrum team sort of grow new relationships based on the ability, the courage to speak their minds and share and work together. So, and in that sense, you create some sort of, it's a different perspective, stakeholders, management, and so on, but you create some sort of peer relationship in which they try to help out each other. So those, let's say, people that have climbed the management ladder, they rediscover the human side. Mm-hmm. The fact that they actually like to work with people and the fact that they actually care for their people. And the people in the teams discover that their managers and so on are also human beings. And try to, again, get them to think in terms of the values and behavior, interaction, collaboration, more than about process. So the illusion of agility, nice, fine. It's an important finding. I think you recognize it also in organizations. The funny thing is I've been speaking to people around the world. That's one of the at least somewhat better aspects of results of the COVID crisis, that I've been able to connect online with people around the world. I can't imagine myself having to do all of that physical traveling.
Yeah.
The downside is obviously what you say, that feeling of disconnect. But this good side is connecting to people around the world, sharing observations, talking about things like you and I are doing now, illusion of agility, the need to humanize the workplace. And although every place, every country, every organization, every department, every team even is unique, still you see a lot of things coming back, like people finding, oh my God, humanizing the workplace, that resonates with me, that attracts me. The illusion of agility, I recognize that. But that's all good. Findings, observations, really important. The honesty, sort of the openness from the Scrum values to confront them, not wipe them under the carpet again, that is an absolutely crucial start. But like I like to say, that sort of the inspection and observation aspect of Scrum, like I like to say, inspection without adaptation is pointless. It makes no sense in the changing dynamics environment. So dynamical environment. So the finding that there's an illusion of agility being created, the finding that the workplace is not being humanized, the finding that people are not re-engaging, not re-finding their intrinsic motivation again, that can only be the start. For me, the adaptation is the goal. What are we going to do? How are we going to act? And that's for me where things come in, like you getting to know the team, trying to create a safe environment, trying to bring up concerns that they've probably been having for a very long time and creating a space where they feel safe to speak up, reconnecting teams with management and stakeholders and leadership. And that the overall thing approach for me is that reimagining your Scrum. So let's look for one initiative. Let's rethink why again are you introducing Scrum? What we were hoping to achieve? What is the biggest urgencies that you sense that you want to do something about? And then let's take an initiative and let's do it with that initiative only. And once we get that going and flowing in an iterative incremental way, because sprint after sprint after sprint, they try to improve and improve not just on the process, but on collaboration, interaction within the team and beyond the team. Once we get that flowing and we've encountered some problems, let's then think about a next initiative. So keep improving the first one and let's think about the next initiative. And in that sense, that's for me truly, truly, literally transforming an organization, because it builds on people's engagement, motivation. It tries to inspire them, at least invites them to participate. We don't overload it with too much things. And often, I don't know whether you recognize that, Greg, but often we run into problems like reestablishing the relationship between often the development departments or the IT departments with the business, the product management people, the salespeople, the marketing people. Mm-hmm. And then we run that things. We run into how to rethink governance, how to rethink a number of structures around our Scrum, procedures, meetings, handovers, and so on. And in the end, for that one initiative, you start running into a number of major challenges. And that's what I used to say to people. Imagine you would have run into this for all teams, all initiatives at the same time. It would be chaos. So let's keep it small. Yeah,
definitely. Yeah. You were talking about, as you were talking, I was thinking you, when you mentioned inspection without it, adaptation is futile. I actually experienced that. It was kind of funny. I took over a Scrum team and from another Scrum master. So, I came in and they were already, they were kind of sort of doing it right. they weren't following it right. So I turned them around. And one of the things that they were doing is, that kind of fits in with this, so they would do their retro, right? And I heard one of the team members said, she's like, I hate the retro. Mm. And I was like, oh, okay. I didn't know why. So, come to find out they were doing the retro, they were doing the inspection part. And she said that they would just simply have conversations, talk about these things, and then that would be it. And they never had action items where they would take action and actually try to implement some changes, right? So all I simply did was had the retro, we did the discussions, and I kept, we used Teams, and I created a little board in there, you know, simple start, stop, continue, and I put an action items column and, you know, had them just, you know, I'm sure you've done this before, simply vote on items you want to bring into the next sprint, and they voted on an item, we brought it in. And we would work on it, and I would keep track of it in the action items list. And when it would get done, we would close it. We would keep adding, right, to the backlog. And then after a few months, she was like, oh, I like retro now. It's really good because, you know, to your point, we closed that loop. We actually inspected and then we adapted. And you're right. It was futile. It was. And I think when I heard you say that, I was like, yeah, I definitely agree with that.
Yeah, and that's a great example you give of how you've helped people see the value of the retrospective. Because in a way, you know, I just noticed what you said. The funny thing is that in a simplistic way, so not simple, in a simplistic way, so a team member coming up to you saying, like you just said, you just experienced, I hate the retros, in a great way is, in a way, we have a point of time to talk about why you hate the retrospective. But that would be the retrospective. So that's a little bit simplistic. Hey, we've got a point of time to talk about that. So I like how you just introducing them. And in a way, again, create that environment and help them see the value of the retrospective. Now, I don't know how you see that, but it's also something you recognize, because I see a lot of teams struggling with the retrospective because of the fact that they often don't work in a very sustainable way, because they're done, they're dead, they're... exhausted by the end of sprint. They're already that they survived the sprint, sprint review, and now I want to go home as quickly as possible. And then, and then they don't engage at the retrospective anymore. So all those things are, it's clear that you recognize that, right?
Yeah. So yeah, the on the what I recognize currently in my current role is it's not something I haven't experienced before. You know, there's always, you always have the quiet ones that just, they just don't want to speak up. And then there's the people that the other extreme, they definitely let you know how they feel, whether you want it or not, right? They're going to give you their opinion and got some loud opinions about Scrum, which I would rather actually have that than a quiet person, because I would rather, I'd want people to tell me how they're feeling. But I do try to come alongside those folks that don't speak up. But in the retro, you're right. It is probably the one that people don't like the most. And as a Scrum Master, for me, it's probably one of the most difficult sessions to help help them understand the value. You go through it. They don't want to do it. They don't think it has value. They don't think they have time to do it is another thing, right? They all these meetings when you first introduce Scrum, you know, I've heard you say before, you know, you've heard this before where they complain about all the meetings. Well, you're supposed to, you're not supposed to, but help them understand that a lot of the meetings that they have can likely go away and be brought into a lot of the Scrum events. Right. I've tried to do that too, but in the retro, because it's a time when I say, okay, let's look back and inspect what we did, what we liked, what we didn't like, and what we want to do better. And then they start realizing, oh, I have to talk. And I try to throw things out there and then pull back in a lot of silence, right? Mm-hmm. And that can be awkward. And I do that on purpose. I leave silence on purpose. And because, you know, after a minute or two, someone's going to speak up. And, because they don't like the silence anymore. But yeah, it's the most challenging event that I've found.
Yeah, and one of the challenges that you just described for you and us as Scrum Masters is indeed to become comfortable with silence.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's not easy, is it?
No.
Just to sit there and wait until at least somebody speaks up, and. Uh-huh. I must honestly say, so I've been doing this Scrum thing since 2003. And in all of those years, I've only met once a team where it really didn't work.
Oh.
Silence, it just kept on. So I've tried to do things in the retrospective, like you just called collecting ideas, dot voting, and so on. Mm-hmm. I've even asked people to work in smaller teams or in pairs, sometimes even. Now, during the retrospective, talk about those topics as two people, then try to bring it back to the group. And in the end, that one team I remember, you know, we always remember the exceptions. Mm-hmm. So that one team where it really didn't work in the end, find out that it was really one person, the most senior, whatever developer, you know, really in the end dominating.
Yeah.
Which just in the end, for whatever reason, that person went, had to leave, whatever. And then after a while, people started doing those things, standing up, speaking up, and so on. And that's where you realize, oh my God, how can one person dominate so much? Even without speaking too much, just by being there, facial expressions, radiating some sense, I don't know.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, my current team, there is a person who, not a dominant voice, but not in a negative way, just someone who likes to talk a lot. Right. And I was able to do a one-on-one, several one-on-ones and still meeting with this person. And, he even said, hey, you know, I probably talk too much, right? I said, yeah, if you could just tone it down a little bit. I appreciate your feedback. You have a lot of good things to say, but I want the team members to speak up, because they were not talking because they know that this person would speak up. And so they would just wait for this person to speak up and then just go along with whatever he said. Yeah. And I was thinking, well, that's okay. Because that's what they're used to, right? Because this person is kind of like a tech lead. So a leader person, right? And they kind of look to this person, and they would go to this person with things instead of coming to me. So I had to kind of work on that. So they would start coming to me instead of going to this. And this person used to be a manager too. So they had that going for them. So I had a little things I had to overcome there. But yeah, once you get through that, then they're starting to open up with me, and it's going better. Yeah.
Yeah, having such a person in the team in a way makes it too easy for the other people, because they can hide behind it, not speak up. You know what? If you stay silent long enough, he or she is always the one that will speak up. Yeah, and how to break that? How to create an environment where everybody feels we can speak up, regardless of seniority or age or whatever. Yeah, and that's again, it's about behavior, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's right. So you mentioned about you touched on engagement is the key. That's I think. So when I think about that, it's not that these people are not engaged. They're good workers, and that's one piece of it. But I guess they don't know. I don't know. What do you think? Would you say that's not being engaged if someone would hold off and not speak up like that, or would you think they're just a quiet person?
Well, both can go, obviously, and I also say that for myself, because I'm actually a quite introvert person. The only times when I really sort of completely go for it is actually in classes or in conversations like this, when I'm on a stage at an event and have to talk. I don't know where it comes from, but it's something inside of me. But outside of that, put me as a student in a class, put me in the audience of an event, and I'll just sit and back silent, listening. And that's often my way of enjoying it too. But in a way, that helps me also work with more introvert people. That's one aspect. The other aspect, engagement is not just being introvert or outspoken for me. Like you say, we meet a lot of very highly competent people. But what I see a lot is what is almost preventing them to really engage is organizational culture. So for years and years and years, when people took an initiative and it was working out fine, we give them applause, we give them champagne, whatever. But when it didn't work out like we expected, or often management or leadership, we chop their heads off.
Yeah.
You know, what happens in the end? People stop doing that because we have not created the context where it feels okay to do that. So it doesn't have to do with competence. It has to do with our tendency to breathe down people's neck all the time. Look at their individual performance. Look at, did you live up to your estimate? So taking a step back, certainly as management and leadership, and I feel you've given a couple of great examples as a Scrum Master, how you have moved from managing individuals towards managing an environment. It's something you would like a lot of management to do that, because it creates breathing space for people. And then again, it takes a while before people actually start engaging again, because we have created cultures of fear.
Yeah.
In the past, we chopped their heads off. So it takes a while. And then often what I've noticed, I don't know whether that connects to your experience, Greg, but it often takes. So we have to be comfortable with silence. I also say, as Scrum Master, we have to be impatiently patient. We see so many potential improvements, so we want to drive that through. Again, if we do too much at a short time, we're going to overload people. But being impatiently patient also means trying to get stakeholders, managers, to get them at a little distance, because often after 2-3 sprints, whatever, they don't see it happening again. That is not a self-organizing team. They don't take their responsibility, whatever. So no, give them more time, because this is a few decades of installing the wrong culture, the culture of fear. Right. You can't undo that in a couple of sprints. In the past, we've said that regularly. Yeah, you can now take initiative. You can self-organize. But it was never true. So it's going to take a while. So in that sense, in order to for me, important to get that engagement rather than trying to enforce that with people, try to look at what is preventing them from engaging. Because I feel it is in our human nature that we want to engage. We want to have joy and fun. We want to contribute to a bigger story. Some sense of purpose is important for us as human beings. But what is keeping us from showing that natural ability, that natural desire to contribute? So, and it's often that culture of fear, what is keeping people from speaking up. And then often, like we already said, it's falling down, getting back up, learning. And what I like also about the leading by example that you also said, also as a scrum master, if I felt every time I overstepped it, if I didn't get any pushback from the team, which is, by the way, the most preferred thing to happen to a scrum master, yeah, getting pushback, yeah, from a team. If that didn't, yeah, happen, and I felt for myself, oh, honestly, oh my God, Gunther, this was not correct, I would share that with the team also spontaneously.
Right.
Just to set a sort of atmosphere that, hey, it's okay to share this.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. When you were talking there, yeah, I was thinking... The culture and you were saying about how, because before I got into, before I even understood what, heard of Scrum or Agile, I'd never heard of, I was in management. And I, one thing that I always liked, just by nature, I really got a lot of enjoyment, not being a manager for the title. And you're mentioning, you know, people move up and they change. And actually what the approach I took was, the workers on my team who like maybe were performing below standards or whatever, right, I would always come to them and try to help those folks out and try to help them improve. And then I realized when I understood what Agile and Scrum was, I was like, yeah, this is, you know, by nature who I am. And that's why it fits. That's why I love it so much, because it just fits with my personality.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate. And I have seen, like you mentioned, I have seen people come from, you know, an individual contributor and move up to management or whatever. And they change. There's this hardening, right? The dehumanizing, right? Mm-hmm. Not humanizing the work. They change and they become, and they don't talk to you as much anymore. Like you said, they feel like they have to be this hard leader. And I think just the opposite. I think it, to show a leader that shows vulnerability and, you know, that you are human, I have much more respect for people like that than someone who's trying to be, you know, in not to bash executives, but I've seen a lot of executives display behavior that, you know, you wouldn't like to see. So yeah, I'm sure you have similar thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally recognize that. In a way, it sort of brings also the idea back of in a way, a good concept of servant leadership. And in a way, sometimes words are important, because when I write servant leadership, I always put a hyphen between the two words, which is not the official way, but it's for me important to express in a way that those two aspects are connected. I often say it's being an authority without having power, or maybe without even wanting to exert power.
So
it's not just servancy. It's not just leadership. It's a combination of the two. Creating the environment, like you've given a couple of examples, where people start striving again. That is so important. So imagine more leadership doing that. So in some CXO teams or management teams, I've translated that into not just servant leadership, but you have to become a sort of servant manager. So I translate that into servant management. And that is very different, because a lot of people think that they have to boss people around. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, you don't have to try to control people individually. It's creating a context where they can engage again, find inspiration again, and find energy again. And in a way, the word control, the fact that you want control is fine because you're management leadership, you care about the health and the survival of the organization. But you know what? Those teams care about that too. And a lot of things in that sense, and you can't see that, but I'm going to put it between quotes. So control in Scrum means, for me, management, leadership, stakeholders regularly meeting with the teams in Scrum at the sprint review, not to check in on what they've done, not to check in on velocity, not to ask teams to justify what they've done or justify their individual estimates. It's about checking in with each other. Where do we stand? What has been done? How can I help you create even more value in the next couple of sprints? And that's, in a way, controlling things from the boundaries of Scrum, from the outset. And that is, for me, so important. But that seems to be a huge shift, which I think is going to be crucial, let's say, for the future of Scrum. Helping managers rethink their role, reinvent themselves within organizations. It's not the same as saying you're a manager, you're bad, you're out, keep out.
Right.
It's about helping them find a better way to be a manager. In that sense, maybe a servant manager. What are you doing to help the team? What are you doing to create a better environment? And if you create that environment, in a way, the results, the output, and certainly the outcome, the impact of the work that the team is doing is going to be a lot bigger. And then you're going to look like a really brilliant manager because the results are better. Because when you just talked about personality and how that connects to you, and you discover that in your maybe your path or your journey to becoming a Scrum Master, as a, can I say that, Greg, as a former manager?
Yeah, it's true. Yes, it's a former manager.
It's something I recognize from my early days in Scrum. I went through exactly the same experience. I was not a manager, but I was a sort of project manager trying to do projects. And then I got into this world of Agile via something called extreme programming. You know that?
Yeah. Yes.
Pair programming and so on. And then mm-hmm. we started with extreme programming with our teams, and then we added Scrum to that as sort of a way to even sort of manage it better, but in a healthy way. And then I discovered, oh my God, it's so cool because this allows me to focus on people and allow, in that sense, self-organization to play within the boundaries of Scrum, within the rules of Scrum, organizing work in sprints, showing results by the end of a sprint, and so on. And certainly in those days, I was back in 2003, let's say 2005, that period. In those days, we over here, we didn't call our thing Scrum because nobody knew what it was. We didn't call it Agile. Yeah. Nobody knew what it was. But in the end, it made me, at some point, I realized that sort of the external world, my organization, my bosses, whatever, they were looking at me like I was sort of the most brilliant project manager ever. And I felt this is not correct because I don't feel I'm doing a lot. It's the team doing the work. They're right. Going through all of the development. They're building quality. They're driven by excellence. I only create an environment. Help me see that to the outside world, to the external world, I looked like a great project manager because the results were great. And those are experiences that my early years of Agile and Scrum and with extreme programming, those are so important for me. They have shown me what the beauty, the power, the potential of this way of working can be.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I've definitely seen the power of it too along my journey. Yeah. So yeah. Well, Gunther, this has been great. I definitely thank you for taking some time out of your day to talk with us and explore humanizing the workplace more. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Hope you've enjoyed our conversation with Gunther Verheyen today, the independent Scrum caretaker. So remember to reach out to me if you want to, Greg Miller at theagilewithin.com with questions, comments, like us, subscribe to us on any of the podcast apps that you listen to. You can reach out to me as well on social media. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all over there. Let me know what you think. So once again, this has been Greg and Gunther and listening to The Agile Within, where we help you to be more agile.
Cool. Thank you again, Greg, for the invitation.
Yeah.
Great conversation.
Yeah.